This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Academic Life, a podcast channel here on New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Gessler, and today we're joined by Professor Belin and Professor Berglund, who are two of the editors of the Diné Reader, an anthology of Navajo literature. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
It's good to be here, Christina.
I'm so glad that you're both here and that we get to talk about this wonderful book and what went into the creation of it. But before we do that, I wonder if you will both tell us about yourselves. Esther, could we begin with you?
Sure. I am from the Navajo Nation, and currently I teach at the Fort Lewis College. And I have written two books of poetry. So while I do focus on poetry quite a bit, I'm also an artist, and I've been doing more group collaborative art around the Four Corners. And I also, something that's interesting is that I was raised in the LA area and have moved back closer to my Navajo homeland.
Thank you. And Jeff, could you tell us about yourself?
Sure. I'm a professor of English at Northern Arizona University, which is located in Flagstaff, Arizona. And I've been here since 1999. And it was probably a year after we moved here that I met Esther and learned of her first book and invited her to campus. And our friendship and professional, working scholarly relationship continued since then. In fact, my most recent publication is on her second book of poetry, of cartography. I regularly teach Native American and Indigenous literature and film. I published a number of co-edited collections, and this most recent book from 2021 was nearly a decade in the making, and one of the richest collaborative experiences of my professional life, working not just with Esther, but also our colleagues, Connie Jacobs and Anthony Webster. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that collaboration.
We will. And before we do that, one thing I like to ask the guests, especially because it's important to the listeners to know more about how people did their own academic journey, I like to ask if you could take us back to when you were looking ahead to college and what you thought you would do and how you got to where you are now. Esther, could we start with you?
Sure. When I started applying to colleges in high school, I only applied to three, and two of them were UC schools because I lived in the LA area. And once I got into UC Berkeley, I just accepted right away. And I think at the time, right, I probably should have held out a little bit longer to hear from the third school. but it was a really good fit for me. The distance was just far enough to be outside of the LA area and close enough where I really could go home and visit my family who's still in Los Angeles. And as far as what I wanted to study, I really thought highly of the health sciences at that time. And I think a lot of that motivation to work in the health field was really because of the lack of Indigenous healthcare workers. And, it obviously wasn't my calling, because I really got engrossed in writing and literature and Indigenous studies at UC Berkeley. So that kind of pivoted my direction as far as undergraduates. And I feel like because I was a first-gen student at a large institution, there was a bit of, academic identity crisis in the sense that I was not sure I was at the right place, and meaning in higher education, because a lot of the material and the relevancy of what I was learning didn't match the reality of Indigenous people, and especially my tribe at that time. The film Broken Rainbow had just won the Academy Award shortly before I entered university. And so I felt there was a sense of urgency for activism and awareness to be with, my community and to really doing work on the ground there. And, so after kind of working through that struggle, I realized that a lot of my work for my community is taking more of the route of higher education. So that's where I am now.
And after college, you did some time at grad school as well?
No, so I took a really unusual route. So I went to, like I said, UC Berkeley, where I was maybe one of, 300, which is an overestimate, of Native students at that university of about 30,000. And that's the undergraduate level. There was probably a little more, including grad students. And, being educated in the LA area, which was extremely diverse, but not diverse within Indigenous community, I actually went to an Indian boarding school, the Institute of American Indian Arts, which operated as a boarding school at that time that I attended. And that was in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And that is actually where I really started feeling more acclimated to my position in education and with my education. So the school at the time had about 200 students, and probably 99% of them were Indigenous. So a lot of my education was just getting to know other Indian students from around the United States, building up my connection through cultural activities. So I took traditional arts as well as printmaking and oil painting. And my official major at the school was in creative writing. And because it operated as a boarding school, it just offered an associate's degree. So I graduated from there with an AA in creative writing. And then that's actually where I met my husband. So we started a family shortly after, and I didn't go back for grad school until years later. So I have four daughters. So I had, I think all my four kids were here by the time I went back to grad school. So, I really tried to blend education within my own community because I grew up off the reservation. So to me, that was equally important, if not more, at that time. And then eventually I did go back to graduate school.
And can you tell us a little bit about your experience at graduate school?
Sure. I think I took a different route again in the sense that I wanted to go back to the LA area. I wanted to specifically study more within the discipline of poetry. And I was an older student because I was already married, had 4 children. And I went to Antioch University, the LA campus. And, they had a social justice component, which really attracted me. And I found really a good community there that had similar kind of motivations for learning about poetry and poetics and the power that it can have. And so a lot of my second book was written in that experience.
Thank you. Jeff, will you tell us about when you were looking ahead to college and how you got from there to here?
Yeah, I'll probably, mine's a little less interesting than Esther's, I think, in a few ways. One is that I was a third generation college student, and my parents were both scientists. So that in interesting ways shaped my initial plan to go also pursue the health sciences and go to medical school. So I was a pre-med major, biology major. And I always tell people the quick version of the story is that organic chemistry changed my mind or changed the course of the path I was on. And I was also taking lots of creative writing and English classes at the time and was very much interested in then pursuing an English major. And so it was that route that led me to grad school at WashU in St. Louis and then eventually to Ohio State University, where I found, I think, the foundation and the seed for the path that I continued to pursue. Like Esther, I met my partner, my wife, Monica, at Ohio State. And while we were on the same degree path to complete a PhD, and while we shared a dissertation advisor, I was a few years ahead of her. And it was eventually that led to us being in Flagstaff at Northern Arizona University. But what I really became interested in graduate school, first at WashU and then especially at Ohio State, was something that I didn't study when I was an undergrad. And that was about the way the power of literature to represent the past, to challenge misconceptions and mythologies about the past, and to also shape the public's imagination about who we are as a nation or as a culture, who individuals are, how cultures are represented, that is, in literature, and how that creates possibilities, right, that are not just limited by the actions of those in the past. And so that's a quick, very general way of summing up some of the ways that I was shaped at Ohio State in my PhD program, and that led to, my current work. What I ended up doing in my dissertation was primarily looking at the way that issues of race and racism, other types of inequities that are linked to differences related to sexuality and gender are represented in literature. And I looked at the figure of the motif of the cannibal or cannibalism. And It was when I was revising that dissertation into my first book called Cannibal Fictions, American Explorations of Race, Colonialism, Gender, and Sexuality, that I added a powerful late chapter that looked at the ways that Indigenous writers were revising and reimagining the cannibal trope, particularly describing and representing colonialism as a not just a form of cannibalism, but as cannibalism. So that's the path of a would-be science major, bio major, pre-med focus to someone who's been teaching in an English department or teaching literature since 1997. Postscript on this is that our daughters are both scientists. one's a med student and one is an engineering student.
And so we're here today to talk about the creation of this book. And I wonder if you will tell us what inspired you to do this book. Esther, could we start with you?
Sure. The origins of the Dené Reader really came from conversations that Connie Jacobs had with myself, but also with Jeff Berglund, who both at the time were teaching Native American literature at different institutions, and both institutions had a high Navajo student population. And, you know, eventually I got invited to participate in this creation and formation of it. But the real need, again, kind of goes back to what I said about my experience in higher education, is that there was just a complete absence, awareness, misunderstanding around Indigenous literature, and particularly around Navajo poetry and poetics and how it's related to language, revitalization, and culture, as well as constructs around race and how that affects, you know, individual students who are going to school on the reservation, on the Navajo reservation, which does abide by state guidelines. So the Navajo reservation includes curriculum guidelines from the states of Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. So depending on where students live, they're exposed to different schools of thought around education, what is incorporated and what's left out. And a common theme that we saw, even in some of the border town areas around the Navajo reservation, was that there was just a missing component of our own voices within literature, within story. And, you know, how the system, the education system, was really enabling that disconnect by not having a text available to use. And so so there was a wide a wide room for us to really develop this text and really discuss and think about it and include all of the different elements that are present in the book.
And it's a very teacher-friendly design for the book. The back has resources for teachers and readers. There's also an extensive timeline. There's biographies of the contributors. There's so much content as well. It's 409 pages long. How long does the creation of a project like this take?
You know, it took probably a decade. I think we haven't really estimated or pinpointed the time period. But also, you know, crucial to the book, which could have made it even longer, right, was including our friend Anthony Webster, who is a linguist and anthropological anthropology linguist, and he added a really nice, a nice view of how Navajo language is created and used in contemporary ways by poets. And so, you know, the book easily could have been longer, and it could have been a little more inclusive of writers. But I think, you know, we were really putting it together for, several years.
One of the things I'd like to add in terms of the process of creating the book and as well as the inspiration is that so many of the writers that we were able to include were well-established and well-regarded, well-published in their own right, either in, their own, with separate books, right? Individual books or many books, in the case of authors like Lucy Tapajanzo, and others had been anthologized from the early 70s on. But what we wanted to do is put many of the writers and their various perspectives and voices in conversation with each other and over and through time. And so we spent quite a bit of time thinking about some of the earliest writers who had fallen to some degree to the wayside, just, you know, by the nature of how the process of time and literary attentiveness works, but also because they hadn't been afforded the opportunity to really find the right readership in their own particular time periods. And then we also were looking to connect to emerging voices, and that was probably the biggest challenge. And in the year since, in the year and a half since this book first came out, you know, more and more writers, you know, are being published and being recognized. And what we quickly and easily, but not dismissively, say is, well, they will be part of another book, volume two, maybe edited by Esther and others, but part of the next volume. By no means is this the final word on Diné literature. In terms of the inspiration for the book, I echo many of the sentiments that that Esther offered, but we working with teachers in the region, especially from the Navajo Nation, we recognize the challenges that teachers face in terms of incorporating a new book such as this into the curriculum, and we wanted to make it as user-friendly as possible, and that's why we wrote pretty extensive biographies, conducted interviews with each of the writers who are living and or willing. I think we have interviews from almost every single writer, but one or two. And then we also enlisted Michael Thompson, who's Muskogee, the only non-Diné contributor to the book of all of the 35 Indigenous contributors who taught for many, many years on the Navajo Nation. And we wanted to enlist his help in developing with the editorial group the resources, because we wanted there to be a simpler way for teachers begin to adopt this book within their own curriculum. We also have an extensive chronology provided by the historian Dr. Jennifer Denetel, a chronology of important events in Navajo history, but also in terms of Diné literary history. And then we have a comprehensive bibliography of both primary sources and secondary sources. And of course, this is still evolving, and we can add to it every single month. So I just wanted to say that while this is a unique book in drawing this many writers together in one place, by no means is this the first time the writers are seeing the light of day in print. Quite the opposite.
One of the things that I really appreciated about the book was the interviews. I'm curious how they were done and how they came about.
Wow, we really worked for those interviews. meaning that some of the contributors live on the Navajo Reservation, and, you know, communication had to be in person. So we really met folks where they're at and spent time with them to get the interviews and, you know, to follow up with things. And so we started off in a variety of ways with the interviews, you know, so meeting with folks and just having conversations with them. And then in, you know, later in our discussions, we realized it might be helpful to have a set of similar questions that everyone's answering, right? Especially around Navajo influences and their writing, and then, you know, who's the first Navajo writer that they've read. And so while most of the interviews have the same set of questions, there's, I think, maybe two that, you know, kind of veer off and into different directions. But the interviews were something that we definitely realized was important. So although it is user-friendly for and teachers, one of the other goals of the book was to make it also really appealing to emerging writers. And so that's why we really wanted to get a photo and include everybody's clan in the biographies, and to get an interview with the writers while they were in the flux of writing and awareness around other Navajo writers in their life.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Something else I'm curious about is how each writer selected what they would be contributing. Esther, you're one of the featured authors. Can you speak to your experience of curating what would be in your section?
Sure. I think, you know, we, as editors, we had a lot of conversations. I often think, like, I wish I took better notes during those conversations, and or if we were even able to record them, because we talked a lot before, you know, any action occurred. We really thought from many angles on what this reader represented, and, you know, thinking of the person picking up and who's going to use it and how useful and what age range. And, you know, we thought from, you know, high school to, you know, first, second year university, but we've heard from people who are using it at middle school level. So that's really exciting. And because of that big expanse, and as Jeff mentioned earlier, many of the writers in the volume are well established and many well-known writings. And so I really, we had a little bit of a dilemma. Do we really reprint a lot of the more well-known writings, or do we try to incorporate this nice arc of what we feel would be a good representation of Navajo literature? And I feel like we had a little bit of a tug back and forth, and I think all of that is included. So really, we tried to go for all of it. And for me, my lens was particular in that I want to make sure that we're capturing certain themes and certain poetic elements. And so that was representative of my work. So I was able to pick and choose my work. And for us, that's how we did it as editors. We really requested certain pieces from each writer.
Christina, this is a great question and an awesome chance to reflect on, you know, that nearly 10-year process. I think we began, as Esther was saying, building sort of wish lists individually as editors. And then we also, when we put the work side by side across all of the authors, started looking for gaps thematically, in terms of form and style, contributions to the unique, you know, story that breaks apart a monolithic idea, you know, of a single version of being Diné and Navajo. And so we are looking for those kinds of complexities. We also recognize that readers will want some of the best of or the standard hits. And so as a matter of kind of balancing that. And then we were also looking at new writers and excerpts from longer works as well. And so all of those things came into play, and then the fairly easy negotiation with writers and then their previous publishers about republishing the older works, right? And so it was a really fun and interesting process, but one that was complex, not very vexed. I think it's a testament to our working relationship and then the incredible generosity and agreeability of the authors with whom we are working. And so in a few cases, we might have, I wouldn't even call it negotiation, we might have, you know, been in discussions with authors about a particular work, and they might have suggested another work in its place. But I don't remember that at all. The two cases that were particularly interesting were with authors who are no longer with us, and so working with their family members and then their collaborators. And that was, you know, an incredible experience as well, and really relied on in-person meetings, for example, with Gray Coho's family, and then another poet, Gloria Emerson, her friendship with the Coho family helped Esther and Connie in particular negotiate bringing Gray Coho's work back into light, the light of day in this collection. Same thing with Tiana Bighorse, although I will say that I negotiated that via email with both her daughter and then her colleague with whom she published.
In the back in the timeline on page 367, it notes that 14 of the authors in this book have graduated as an undergraduate or from a graduate program at the Institute of American Arts, and others have taught there. It seems then that the Institute of American Arts has been really pivotal for Navajo literature. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. You know, you know, I think as far as boarding school projects, the Institute of the American Indian Arts really focused in on that, the arts, and creative arts is an expression. And I think that success that came out of the school was because of that. You know, when we talk about intergenerational trauma and inherited trauma from boarding school experience, as well as other U.S. federal Indian policies, you know, a lot of trauma response is an inability to articulate verbally. And so the arts are just a natural way to have a nonverbal expression and to really unfold all of the complexity around not only just that person, but the past, and then also creating the legacy forward. And so I don't feel like that may have been, you know, in the planning, but I feel like that is definitely the result. And, you know, and like I said, when I went there, it truly operated as a boarding school. And so the admission process was, you know, I think more simplified than regular university application. It really just had to be a simple portfolio and initiative to develop creatively as well as academically and be challenged that way. And I think the community actually was the strength for me. All the different students who seemed to be working constantly, right, in the paint studio, in the pottery studio, in their dorm rooms, writing. And it was just that energy and that flow, I think, that really allowed for people to join in on that creativity. And so I it is a really interesting collection that includes so many representatives from that school, and the draw there, I think, is still that it is small, it is arts focused, and it is an Indigenous school where you will meet people from all over, you know, all over the United States and First Nations, and some international students as well. When I was there, there were quite a number of Japanese students. So I think that international feel and intertribal feel was and is truly a nice foundation for emerging writers. And also it's representative of the contributors in the collection.
We've talked about some of the contents of the book and how teacher-friendly and user-friendly it is for people from a variety of ages. You said as young as middle school. I was thinking this could also easily be assigned in graduate school because there's so many layers to the work. And as people mature, they'll see different things to connect with. But when you pick up the book, the first thing you notice is the artwork on the cover. I was wondering if we could talk about the art, the creator of the art, and the selection of this piece.
Yeah, I'll let Jeff talk about the artwork, but I do want to mention, you know, we weren't short on trying to figure out who would be on the cover. We have Vinaya Yazzie, Gloria Emerson, Sherwin Bitsui, as well as Shanto and myself, who did visual art. So our problem, I think, was just finding the right piece.
That was definitely the case. And Shanto Bouquet lives and works today for many years in Flagstaff. And so I've known him and known the work that he produced for children as well, that includes his paintings as well as his prose and poetry. And so in the process of including Shanto's written work, I began kind of surveying a number of his paintings. And what jumped out to me is the number of paintings of Shanto's that feature mainly young boys or young men reading. And they're often in a natural environment reading, often either with sheep while they're sheep herding or with their dog, presumably also while they're sheep herding. And when I interviewed Shanto in his studio downtown Flagstaff, he was actually working on a little library, like a lending library, a couple of pieces that featured, again, images of young Diné men reading. And then we were talking about this particular painting that ended up on the cover as one called The Story Rock that hangs in the Phoenix Public Library that features a young man reading on a large rock. And I asked him about this recurring image or theme in his paintings. And he said it's really autobiographical and reflects a younger version of himself. He used to read when he was charged with herding the sheep, and he always had a book with him. And he also kept books, and I think he mentions this in the interview. He mentions keeping books wrapped up in plastic at two different locations at either end of where he would range while sheep herding, and they were his library that he borrowed from during the day on these various trips. And in the interview, he speaks about the possibility of books transporting you beyond, almost acting like a spaceship of sorts or a magic carpet, allowing you to experience new things and to visit new places. And so I thought that was a powerful image, and it ended up leading us to choose the title for the book as well, punning in some ways on the image. So those of you who are listening and who haven't seen the cover of the book, Shanto Begay's paintings are often done in this, impressionistic style. It's not exactly pointillism, but there are elements that might remind you of Van Gogh's paintings, as well as some of the other French impressionists. In this particular painting, there are earth tones from the desert southwest, rust, gold, oranges, some sage color. And then there's, in this particular painting, an ominous, to some views, ominous looking sky with dark swirling clouds in some of the darker tones, black and gray and the blues. But then in the standing in the center, firmly, without worry, seemingly, and with dedicated focus, is this young person, this young man, reading a book.
You mentioned, Esther, that a number of the contributors are visual artists as well, and as are you. Was there consideration to including more visual art within the book, or was it always going to be one piece selected just for the cover?
We definitely had conversations around that, around how can we incorporate more of the art. And again, like I said, the book could have been much larger. And I also forgot to mention Natanya Pulley and Tina Deschitney. They have been doing this great collage work. And so I think that's not uncommon for just Diné people to really have multiple mediums of creative process. And I think for me, I know I've heard it from Sherwin, the physical process of creating two-dimensional pieces really is a nice complement to more of the cognitive process of writing. And so I think that's another balance. So we did talk about possibly including artwork from everyone, and we just weren't sure how that would work because we already had not a large amount of illustration, but we had a couple images in the beginning of the book, and we just weren't, and then we had pictures of everyone. So we really just weren't sure how to embrace that. And as we were thinking of images as well, it also led to conversations around, do we need divisions in the book? How do we divide things up? And, you know, the final, of course, was just to leave a lot of the visual art, all of the visual art out, except for the last comic by Tatum.
And I think, I wanted to address the graphic story that's the last entry in the book as well by Tatum Begay. But I will say that on some level, production issues, so financial issues come into play. So if we wanted to keep a price point down and a reasonable, to make this, again, more accessible to all readers, we had to give up the idea of including color plates within for some of the images. And we thought, well, maybe that would be for another book. But we did seriously consider including other images beyond the cover painting by Chanteau Begay. We did include the visual narrative created by Tatum Begay for the book. Tatum is a artist, graphic illustrator, done a number of zines and comics, and we are looking to include her work. And through our discussions with her, we broached the subject of creating something that might thematically resonate at the end of the book and implicitly comment on the journey of a young Dene writer. And one of the things that she was able to capture, present in the beginning part of this primarily wordless story, there are a few, few bits of dialogue, but it's they're only two different frames of the graphic story include dialogue. What she was able to convey is that Danae's storytelling and what is now connected to the quote literary arts has a deep and a long history through time immemorial. And it included elements that were highly visual. And so her story opens with a grandfather and a granddaughter, or an elderly man if it's not the grandfather, teaching a young woman using a sand painting and some visual elements in the sand painting. And then we later see the young artist, maybe Tatum herself, drawing elements from the sand painting, but on her own outside of a ceremonial context. And it's out of that foundation that her artistry is born. And she eventually imagines herself as a published writer on a bookshelf between some of her literary heroes that include, Japanese artists and artists like writers like Shakespeare, as well as Laura Tohi and Lucy Tapahanzo, both Navajo Nation poet laureates.
In the acknowledgments, you give us a sort of behind the scenes glimpse of how many people are involved in the creation of something like this, including, as you've referenced earlier in our conversation, working with descendants of some of the creators who are no longer alive. And you also mention one poet in particular, Joy Harjo. And I was thinking about how she also provided a blurb for the back of the book and the importance when we talk about community of mentorship. It sounds like she was a mentor to you, Esther.
I think in a literary way, I was mentored by all Indigenous writers and definitely had some moments of action and gratitude for Joy And, you know, so I met her briefly while I was a student at the Institute of American Indian Arts. And, you know, over the years have had interaction and support whenever I've seen her in passing. And, you know, so we definitely intentionally reached out to Joy at the time, who was serving as the Poet Laureate of the United States, and as well as Simon Ortiz, another foundational writer within Indigenous poetics, and to really kind of give us, you know, a really good perspective of honor by, you know, in a sort of way, really blessing the work that we've done, you know, because I do see them as my elders. I see them as forerunners in writing and knowing the struggles that I've had as an Indigenous writer, knowing that, you know, they paved the way for me and others in the book. And actually others in the book are their contemporaries, right? I think Joy was at the IAIA possibly at the same time that Black Horse was there and Gloria was there and maybe even Shanto. So I think there was overlap and awareness of everyone who's writing and doing the arts. So I think in that sense, it's very much of a community, but again, also an honoring that, you know, she was inspirational in her work, but also really acknowledging that the work that we've done. And so really appreciating that from her.
You talk about going to the community and doing the interviews in person with a number of the contributors and working in the art community to create the list of who would be in the book and what works could be included. There's such a community process of this work. How has it been received by the community?
Yeah, I feel like people have anticipated the book for a long time because we have been working on it pretty, you know, intentionally the last 5 years, really just having those conversations with people and assessing the need and getting direction. So I feel it is well received from folks I talk to. And not only on the reservation, but also at other universities, having talked to people who are using the text and reach out and ask questions about certain things. And so that's been really great because we want it to be used and we don't want it to be static. And we also want folks to know that this is really just a small representation of everyone out there who is a writer, right? And who is part of this storytelling process. And, you know, I often say that in that, you know, many of the writers in the book, you know, don't have a single volume book published, but they've been published in different areas. So they've made themselves known through their writing as being writers, and they might have other careers. But I think part of that also, every family, every Navajo family probably has somebody who is the writer of the family, the person who is asked to represent and speak in public or to write a poem about this or to craft some kind of memorial to honor this or that. And so I think that is something that is maybe unique to Indigenous communities, but I feel like, again, that this is really just a small but significant recognition of all the writers who are out there, who are writing with and for the Navajo people.
I know we're running short on time, so before I need to let you both go, I want to ask you each, what do you hope this episode will spark for listeners? Jeff, can we begin with you?
Well, I would love for readers who have never encountered a Diné writer, or maybe even an Indigenous writer, which is often the case, by the way, in the classrooms I teach here in Arizona, where there are 23 tribes, students come to my classrooms having never read an Indigenous writer. I've been at dinner tables where highly educated people have asked me, Indigenous people really write? So what my basic hope would be is that you check out Indigenous writing, period, but especially check out a number of the writers in this anthology. If you can't buy the book, find it at your local library. If you can't find it at your local library, take a look at the University of Arizona Press's catalog page and see the number of writers that are listed. A lot of the writers' work is available online. Esther just edited 3 different volumes in a special series for poetry. And there are a number of Indigenous writers and Diné writers who are included there. So that is my hope, that you'll look at the beauty and the artistry, the complexity, and really the diversity of perspectives offered by Indigenous writers.
And Esther?
Yeah, equally with, Jeff's statement. And also really for the Indigenous writers out there, I feel that, the more I learn about Navajo language and the complexity and the worldview of our words with the world and our space really validates the struggle with Native students to write in the English language, because they are in conflict. Those two mediums are in conflict, and so understanding that really too, as an offering for these young Navajo students, young Navajo writers, who I see in the classroom and really have taken a beating as far as their value because of, their struggle with the English language or the grammar of the English language. And to really present this book as an offering to say, we have our own grammar. We have our own poetics. We have our own system. And to really encourage that way, not only just the writers, but also the young students who are developing these writing skills, and saying that both is possible, right? So, working at a writing in whatever field you're in of writing is a skill, and that it is attainable, and also that this is not just our moment. This is kind of one pin on the timeline, and we're looking for people to continue these conversations because it's ongoing, and we're seeing more writers take up the challenge to study literature and with a Navajo, with a Indigenous lens. And then also starting to command some of that in research methodologies, and to really make present more of our poetics, which I think, again, combats that whole, all of the structures of colonialism that are still present. So really, really want this book to be a contribution of that decolonial and healing process. for dinner.
Thank you both so much for being here today and telling us about your book and what inspired you to create it. This is The Academic Life on New Books Network. I hope you will please join us again.